sixth inning. When Tricia woke up, the birds were singing confidently. The light was strong and bright, the way it looked at mid-morning. She might have slept even longer, but hunger wouldn't allow it. She roared with a vast emptiness from the top of her throat all the way down to her knees, and in the very middle it hurt, actually hurt. It was as if she were being pinched somewhere inside. The feeling frightened her. She had been hungry before, but never hungry enough for it to hurt this way. She backed out of her shelter, knocking it over again, got to her feet, and hobbled to the stream with her hands planted in the small of her back. She probably looked like Pepsi Robichaud's grandmother, the one who was deaf and had arthritis so bad she had to use a walker. Granny Grunt, Pepsi called her. Tricia got down on her knees, planted her hands, and drank like a horse at a trough. If the water made her sick again, and it probably would, so be it. She had to put something in her stomach. She got up, looked dully around her, hitched up her jeans. They had been okay when she put them on long ago and far away in her Sanford bedroom, but they were loose now. Then she started downhill along the course of the stream. She no longer had any real hope that it would take her out, but at least she could put some distance between her and Tricia's puking place. She could do that much. She had gotten perhaps 100 paces when the tough Tootsie spoke up. "Forgot something, didn't you, sugar?" Today the tough Tootsie also sounded like a getting tired Tootsie, but her voice was as cold and ironic as ever, not to mention correct. Tricia stood where she was for a moment with her head down and her hair hanging, then turned around and labored uphill to her little camp of the night before. She had to stop twice on the way and give her pounding heart a chance to slow down. She was appalled by how little strength she had left. She filled her water bottle, stuffed it and the shredded remains of her poncho into her pack, gave a tearful sigh at the pack's weight when she lifted it, the damn thing was all but empty, for goodness sake, and then set off again. She walked slowly, almost plodding now, and although the going was downhill, she still had to stop and rest every 15 minutes or so. Her head throbbed. All the world's colors looked too bright, and when a blue jay called from a branch overhead, the sounds seemed to punch into her ears like needles. She pretended Tom Gordon was with her, keeping her company. And then after a while, she didn't have to pretend anymore. He walked along beside her, and although she knew he was an hallucination, he looked as real by daylight as he had by moonlight. Around noon, Tricia stumbled over a rock and sprawled full length in a brambly snarl of bushes. She lay there with the breath knocked out of her and her heart hammering so hard it made white lights in front of her eyes. The first time she attempted to drag herself back to open ground, she couldn't do it. She waited, rested, tried for stillness with her eyes half closed, and then went for it again. This time she pulled herself free, but when she tried to get up, her legs wouldn't support her. No wonder, either, not really. Over the last 48 hours, she'd had nothing to eat but a hard-boiled egg, a tuna sandwich, 2 Twinkies, and a few fiddleheads. She'd also had diarrhea and vomiting. "I'm going to die, Tom, aren't I?" she asked. Her voice was calm, lucid. There was no answer. Tricia raised her head and looked around. Number 36 was gone. Tricia dragged herself over to the stream and had a drink. The water didn't seem to be bothering her stomach and bowels anymore. She didn't know if that meant she was getting used to it, or just that her body had given up trying to rid itself of the bad stuff, the impurities. Tricia sat up, wiped her dripping mouth, and looked northwest along the course of the stream. The terrain up ahead was moderating, and the old forest seemed to be changing once again, the firs giving way to smaller, younger trees. Your basic forest clenches and tangles, in other words, with plenty of underbrush clogging up any easy way through. She didn't know how long she could continue in that direction, and if she tried to walk in the stream, she guessed that the current would bowl her over. There were no helicopters, no barking dogs. She had an idea she could hear those sounds if she wanted to, just as she could see Tom Gordon if she wanted to, so it was best not to think in that direction. If any sounds surprised her, they might be real. Tricia didn't think any sounds would surprise her. "I'm going to die in the woods." Not a question this time. Her face twisted into an expression of sorrow, but there were no tears. She held out her hands and looked at them. They were trembling. At last she got to her feet and began to walk again. As she made her way slowly downhill, clutching at tree trunks and branches to keep from falling over, two detectives from the Attorney General's office were questioning her mother and brother. Later that afternoon, a psychiatrist who worked with the state police would try to hypnotize them, and with Pete, he would succeed. The focus of their questions had to do with pulling into the parking lot on Saturday morning and getting ready to hike. Had they seen a blue van? Had they seen a man with blonde hair and eyeglasses? "Dear Christ," Quilla said, finally giving in to the tears she had until now largely held off. "Dear Christ, you think my baby was kidnapped, don't you? Snatched from behind us while we were arguing." At that, Pete also began to cry. In TR-90, TR-100, and TR-110, the search for Tricia went on. But the perimeter had been tightened, the men and women in the woods instructed to concentrate more fully on the area near where the girl had last been seen. The searchers were now looking more for the girl's effects than for the girl herself. Her pack, her poncho, articles of her clothing. Not her panties, though. The AG's men and the state police detectives were pretty sure no one would find those. Guys like Mazzaroli usually kept their victims' undergarments, holding on to them long after the bodies had been tossed into ditches or stuffed into culverts. Tricia McFarland, who had never seen Frances Raymond Mazzaroli in her life, was now 30 miles beyond the northwest perimeter of the new, tighter search area. The Maine State Guides and Forest Service's game wardens would have found this difficult to believe even without the false tip to distract them, but it was true. She was no longer in Maine. At around 3 o'clock that Monday afternoon, she crossed over into New Hampshire. It was an hour or so after that when Tricia saw the bushes near a stand of beech trees not far from the stream. She walked toward them, not daring to believe even when she saw the bright red berries. Hadn't she just told herself that she could see things and hear them if she wanted to badly enough? True. But she'd also told herself that if she was surprised, the things she saw and heard might be real. Another 4 steps convinced her that the bushes were real. The bushes and the lush freight of checkerberries hanging all over them like tiny apples. "Berries, ho!" she cried in a cracked, hoarse voice, and any last doubts were removed when the two crows which had been feasting on dropped fruit a little farther into the tangle took wing, cawing at her reprovingly. Tricia meant to walk, but found herself running instead. When she reached the bushes, she stopped on her heels, breathing hard, her cheeks flushed in thin lines of color. She reached out with her filthy hands, then pulled them back, still convinced on some level that when she tried to touch, her fingers would go right through. The bushes would shimmer like a special effect in a movie, one of Pete's beloved morphs, and then they would show themselves for what they really were, just more tangles of cruddy brown brambles, ready to drink as much of her blood as they could while it was still warm and flowing. "No," she said, and reached forward. For a moment, she still wasn't sure. And then, oh, and then, the checkerberries were small and soft under her fingertips. She squashed the first one she picked. It spurted droplets of red juice onto her skin and made her think of once when she had been watching her father shave and he had nicked himself. She raised the finger with the droplets on it and a little scrap of deflated berry skin to her mouth and put it between her lips. The taste was tangy sweet, reminding her not of tea berry gum, but of cranapple juice, just poured from a bottle kept cold in the refrigerator. The taste made her cry, but she wasn't aware of the tears spilling down her cheeks. She was already reaching for more berries, stripping them from the leaves in sticky, bleeding bunches, cramming them into her mouth, hardly chewing, simply swallowing them and groping for more. Her body opened itself to the berries, basked in their sugary arrival. She felt this happen, was totally down with it, as Pepsi might have said. Her thinking self seemed far away, watching it all. She harvested the berries from their branches, closing her hand around whole clumps of them and pulling them off. Her fingers turned red, her palms, so in very short order did her mouth. As she pushed deeper into the bushes, she began to look like a girl who had been in a nasty cutting scrape and needed a quick patch-up in the nearest emergency room. She ate some of the leaves as well as the berries, and her mother had been right about them, too. They were good even if you weren't a woodchuck. Zippy. The two tastes combined made her think of the jelly Grandma McFarland served with roast chicken. She might have gone on eating her way south for quite a while longer, but the berry patch came to an abrupt end. Tricia emerged from the last clump of bushes and found herself looking into the mild, startled face and dark brown eyes of a good-sized doe. She dropped a double handful of berries and screamed through what now looked like a crazy application of lipstick. The doe hadn't been bothered by her crackling, munching progress through the checkerberry tangle and seemed just mildly annoyed by Tricia's scream. It occurred to Tricia later that this was one deer who would be lucky to survive hunting season come fall. The doe merely flicked her ears and took two springy steps. They were more like bounces, actually, back into a clearing which was shafted by conflicting rays of dusky green-gold light. Beyond her, watching more warily, were two fawns on gangly legs. The doe took another look over her shoulder at Tricia, then crossed with those light, springing steps to her kids. Watching her, amazed and as delighted as she had been at the sight of the beavers, Tricia thought that the doe moved like a creature with a thin coating of that flubber stuff on her feet. The three deer stood in the beech clearing, almost as if posing for a family portrait. Then the doe nudged one of the fawns, or perhaps bit its flank, and the three of them were on their way. Tricia saw the flirt of their white tails going downhill, and then she had the clearing to herself.
"Goodbye," she called. "Thanks for stopping by."
She stopped, realizing what the deer had been doing there. The forest floor was littered with beech nuts. She knew about these not from her mother, but from science class at school. 15 minutes ago, she had been starving. Now she was in the middle of Thanksgiving dinner. The vegetarian version, yeah, but so what? Tricia knelt, picked up one of the nuts, and set the remains of her fingernails in the shell's seam. She didn't expect much, but it opened almost as easily as a peanut. The shell was the size of a knuckle, the nut meat a little bigger than a sunflower seed. She tried it, a bit dubious, but it was good. In its own way, it was as good as the checkerberries, and her body seemed to want it in a different way. The worst of her hunger had been satisfied by the berries. She had no idea how many she had already gobbled, not to mention the leaves. Her teeth were probably as green as Arthur Rhodes, that creepy little kid who lived up the street from Pepsi. Besides, her stomach had probably shrunk. What she had to do now was...
"Stock up," she muttered.
"Yeah, baby, stock up big time."
She unshouldered her pack, aware of how radically her energy level had rebounded already. It was beyond amazing, actually a little eerie, and unbuckled the flap. She crawled across the clearing, gathering nuts with dirty hands. Her hair hung in her eyes, her filthy shirt flapped, and every now and again she hitched at her jeans, which had been all right when she put them on 1,000 years ago, but no longer wanted to stay up. As she gathered, she sang the auto glass jingle, 1-800-54-GIANT, under her breath. When she had enough beech nuts to weigh down the bottom of the pack, she worked her way slowly back through the checkerberry patch, picking berries and dumping them, the ones she didn't just dump into her mouth, in on top of the nuts. When she reached the place where she had stood earlier, trying to muster enough courage to reach out and touch what she saw, she felt almost herself again. Not entirely, but still pretty good. Whole was the word that occurred to her, and she liked it so well she said it out loud. Not once, but twice. She trudged to the brook, dragging the pack beside her, then sat down under a tree. In the water, like a happy omen, she saw a small, speckled fish shoot by in the direction of the flow, a baby trout, perhaps. Tricia sat where she was for a moment, turning her face up to the sun and closing her eyes. Then she dragged her pack into her lap and put her hand inside, mixing the berries and nuts together. Doing this made her think of Uncle Scrooge McDuck playing around in his money vault, and she laughed delightedly. The image was absurd and perfect at the same time. She hauled a dozen or so of the beech nuts, mixed them with a like number of berries, this time using her matter-stained fingers to remove the stems with ladylike care,
and tossed the result into her mouth in 3 measured handfuls. Dessert. The taste was heavenly, like one of those trail mix breakfast cereals her mother always ate, and when Tricia had finished the last handful, she realized she wasn't just full, but gorged. She didn't know how long the feeling would last. Probably nuts and berries were like Chinese food. They filled you up, and an hour later you were hungry again. But right now, her midsection felt like an overloaded Christmas stocking. It was wonderful to be full. She had lived 9 years without knowing that, and she hoped she would never forget. It was wonderful to be full. Tricia leaned back against the tree and looked into her knapsack with deep happiness and gratitude. If she hadn't been so full, too stuffed to jump, she thought, she would have stuck her head in like a mare sticking her head into an oat sack just to fill her nose with the delicious combined smell of the checkerberries and beechnuts.
Saved my life, you guys, she said. Saved my gosh darn life.
On the far side of the rushing stream, there was a little clearing carpeted with pine needles. Sunlight fell into it in bright yellow bars filled with slow-dancing pollen and woods dust. Butterflies also played in this light, dipping and swooping. Tricia crossed her hands on her belly, where the roaring was now still, and watched the butterflies. In that moment, she did not miss her mother, father, brother, or best friend. In that moment, she did not even want to go home, although she ached all over and her butt stung and itched and chafed when she walked. In that moment, she was at peace. And more than at peace, she was experiencing her life's greatest contentment.
If I get out of this, I'll never be able to tell them, she thought.
She watched the butterflies on the other side of the stream, her eyelids drooping. There were 2 white ones. The 3rd was velvety dark brown, or maybe black.
Tell them what, sugar?
It was the tough Tootsie, but for once she didn't sound cold, only curious.
What there really is. How simple. Just to eat. Why, just to have something to eat and then to be full afterward.
The sub audible, Tricia said. She watched the butterflies, 2 white and 1 dark, all 3 dipping and darting in the afternoon sun. She thought of little black Sambo up in the tree, the tigers running around down below and wearing his fine new clothes, running and running until they melted and turned into butter, into what her dad called ghee. Her right hand came unlaced from her left, rolled over, and thumped palm up to the ground. It seemed like too much work to put it back, and so Tricia let it stay where it was.
The subaudible what, sugar? What about it?
Well, Tricia said in a slow, sleepy, considering voice,
it's not like that's nothing, is it?
The tough Tootsie didn't reply. Tricia was glad. She felt so sleepy, so full, so wonderful. She didn't sleep, though. Even later, when she knew she must have slept, it didn't seem as if she had. She remembered thinking about her dad's backyard behind the newer, smaller house, how the grass needed cutting and the lawn dwarves looked sly, as if they knew something you didn't, and about how Dad had started to look sad and old to her, with that smell of beer always coming out of his pores. Life could be very sad, it seemed to her. And mostly, it was what it could be. People made believe that it wasn't, and they lied to their kids. No movie or television program she had ever seen had prepared her for losing her balance and plopping back into her own crap, for instance, so as not to scare them or bum them out. But yeah, it could be sad. The world had teeth, and it could bite you with them any time it wanted. She knew that now. She was only 9, but she knew it, and she thought she could accept it. She was almost 10 after all, and big for her age. I don't know why we have to pay for what you guys did wrong. That was the last thing she had heard Pete say, and now Tricia thought she knew the answer. It was a tough answer, but probably a true one. Just because. And if you didn't like it, take a ticket and get in line. Tricia guessed that in a lot of ways she was older than Pete now. She looked downstream and saw that another stream came pouring into hers about 40 yards from where she was sitting. It came over the bank in a spraying little waterfall. Good deal. This was the way it was supposed to work. This second stream she had found would get bigger and bigger. This one would lead her to people. She shifted her eyes back to the little clearing on the other side of the stream, and three people were standing there, looking at her. At least she assumed they were looking at her. Trisha couldn't see their faces, their feet either. They wore long robes like the priests in those movies about days of old. In days of old, when knights were bold and ladies showed their fannies, Pepsi Robichaud sometimes sang when she jumped rope. The hems of these robes puddled on the clearing's carpet of needles. Their hoods were up, hiding the faces within. Trisha looked across the stream at them, a little startled but not really afraid. Not then. Two of the robes were white. The one worn by the figure in the middle was black.
"Who are you?"
Trisha asked. She tried to sit up a little straighter and found she couldn't. She was too full of food. For the first time in her life, she felt as if she had been drugged with food.
"Will you help me? I'm lost. I've been lost for..."
She couldn't remember. Was it 2 days or three?
"For a long time. Will you please help me?"
They didn't answer, only stood there looking at her. She assumed they were looking at her anyway. And that was when Trisha began to feel afraid. They had their arms crossed on their chests, and you couldn't even see their hands because the long sleeves of their robes flowed over them.
"Who are you? Tell me who you are."
The one on the left stepped forward, and when he reached up to his hood, his white sleeves fell away from long white fingers. He pushed the hood back and revealed an intelligent, if rather horsey, face with a receding chin. He looked like Mr. Bork, the science teacher at Sanford Elementary, who had taught them about plants and animals of northern New England, including, of course, the world-famous beechnut. Most of the boys and some of the girls, Pepsi Robichaud, for instance, called him Bork the Dork. He looked at her from across the stream and from behind little gold-rimmed spectacles.
"I come from the god of Tom Gordon," he said. "The one he points up to when he gets the save."
"Yes?" Trisha asked politely. She wasn't sure she trusted this guy. If he'd said he was the god of Tom Gordon, she knew damned well she wouldn't have trusted him. She could believe a lot of things, but not that God looked like her fourth-grade science teacher.
"That's very interesting."
"He can't help you," Bork the Dork said. "There's a lot going on today. There's been an earthquake in Japan, for instance, a bad one. As a rule, he doesn't intervene in human affairs anyway, although I must admit, he is a sports fan. Not necessarily a Red Sox fan, however."
He stepped back and raised his hood. After a moment, the other white robe, the one on the right, stepped forward, as Trisha had known he would. These things had a certain form to them, after all. Three wishes, three trips up the beanstalk, three sisters, three chances to guess the evil dwarf's name, not to mention three deer in the woods eating beechnuts.
"Am I dreaming?" she asked herself, and reached up to touch the wasp sting on her left cheekbone.
It was there, and although the swelling had gone down some, touching it still hurt. Not a dream. But when the second white robe pushed back his hood and she saw a man who looked like her father, not exactly, but as much like Larry McFarland as the first white robe had looked like Mr. Bork, she thought it had to be. If so, it was like no other dream she'd ever had.
"Don't tell me," Trisha said. "You come from the subaudible, right?"
"Actually, I am the subaudible," the man who looked like her father said apologetically. "I had to take the shape of someone you know in order to appear, because I'm actually quite weak. I can't do anything for you, Trisha. Sorry."
"Are you drunk?" Trisha asked, suddenly angry. "You are, aren't you? I can smell it from here. Boy!"
The subaudible guy gave her a shamefaced little smile, said nothing, stepped back, raised his hood. Now the figure in the black robe stepped forward. Trisha felt sudden terror.
"No," she said. "Not you."
She tried to get up and still couldn't move.
"Not you. Go away. Give me a break."
But the black-clad arms rose, falling away from yellow-white claws. The claws that had left the marks on the trees. The claws that had torn off the deer's head and then ripped its body apart.
"No,"
Trisha whispered.
"No, don't. Please, I don't want to see."
The black robe paid no attention. It pushed back its hood. There was no face there, only a misshapen head made of wasps. They crawled over each other, jostling and buzzing. As they moved, Trisha saw disturbing ripples of human feature. An empty eye, a smiling mouth. The head hummed as the flies had hummed on the deer's ragged neck. It hummed as though the creature in the black robe had a motor for a brain.
"I come from the thing in the woods," the black robe said in a buzzing, inhuman voice.
He sounded to Trisha like that guy on the radio who told you not to smoke. The one who had lost his vocal cords in a cancer operation and had to talk through a gadget he held to his throat.
"I come from the god of the lost. It has been watching you. It has been waiting for you. It is your miracle, and you are its."
"Go away."
Trisha tried to yell this, but only a husky, whining whisper actually came out.
"The world is a worst-case scenario, and I'm afraid all you sense is true," said the buzzing, wasp voice.
Its claws raked slowly down the side of its head, goring through its insect flesh and revealing the shiny bone beneath.
"The skin of the world is woven of stingers, a fact you have now learned for yourself. Beneath, there is nothing but bone and the god we share. This is persuasive. Do you agree?"
Terrified, crying, Trisha looked away, looked back down the stream. She found that when she wasn't looking at the hideous wasp priest, she could move a little. She raised her hands to her cheeks, wiped away her tears, then looked back.
I don't believe you. I don't."
The wasp priest was gone. All of them were gone. There were only butterflies dancing in the air across the stream, 8 or 9 now instead of just 3, all different colors instead of just white and black. And the light was different. It had begun to take on a gold-orange hue. 2 hours had gone by at least, probably more like 3. So she had slept. It was all a dream, as they said in the stories, but she couldn't remember going to sleep no matter how hard she tried, couldn't remember any break in her chain of consciousness at all, and it hadn't felt like a dream. An idea occurred to Trisha then, one which was simultaneously frightening and oddly comforting. Perhaps the nuts and berries had gotten her high as well as feeding her. She knew there were mushrooms that could get you high, that sometimes kids ate pieces of them to get off, and if mushrooms could do that, why not checkerberries? "Or the leaves," she said. Maybe it was the leaves. I bet it was. Okay, no more of them, Zippy or not. Trisha got up, grimaced as a cramp pulled at her belly and bent over. She passed gas and felt better. Then she went to the stream, spotted a couple of good-sized rocks sticking out of the water, and used them to hop across. In some ways, she felt like a different girl, clear-eyed and full of energy. Yet the thought of the wasp priest haunted her, and she knew her unease would only get worse after the sun went down. If she wasn't careful, she'd have the horrors. But if she could prove to herself it had only been a bad dream, brought on by eating checkerberry leaves, or maybe by drinking water that her system still wasn't entirely used to. Actually, being in the small clearing made her feel nervous. Like a character in a slasher movie, the stupid girl who goes into the psycho's house asking, "Is anybody here?" She looked back across the stream, immediately felt that something was looking at her from the woods on the side, and reversed direction so fast she almost fell down. Nothing there. Nothing anywhere, as far as she could tell.
"You dingbat," she said softly,
but that feeling of being watched had come back, and come back strong. "The god of the lost," the wasp priest had said. "It has been watching you. It has been waiting for you." The wasp priest had said other things too, but that was what she remembered.
"Watching you. Waiting for you."
Trisha went to where she was pretty sure she had seen the 3-robed figures and looked for any sign of them, any sign at all. There was nothing. She dropped to 1 knee to look more closely, and there was still nothing. Not so much as a patch of scuffed needles, which her frightened mind could have interpreted as a footprint. She got up again, turned across the stream, and as she did, something in the forest to her right caught her eye. She walked in that direction, then stood looking into the tangled darkness where young trees with thin trunks grew close together, fighting for space and light above ground, no doubt fighting with the grasping bushes for moisture and root room below. Here and there in the darkening green, birches stood like gaunt ghosts. Splashed across the bark of one of these was a stain. Trisha looked nervously over her shoulder, then pushed her way into the woods and toward the birch. Her heart was thumping hard in her chest, and her mind was screaming at her to stop this, to not be such a fool, such a dingbat, such an asshole. But she went on. Lying at the foot of the birch was a snarly coil of bleeding intestine, so fresh that it had as yet collected only a few flies. Yesterday, the sight of such a thing had had her struggling with all her might not to throw up. But life seemed different today. Things had changed. There were no butter flutters, no meaty hiccups way down deep in her throat, no instinctive urge to turn away or at least avert her eyes. Instead of these things, she felt a coldness that was somehow much worse. It was like drowning, only from the inside out. There was a swatch of brown fur caught in the bushes to one side of the guts, and on it she could see a spatter of white spots. This was the remains of a fawn, one of the two she had come upon in the beechnut clearing, she was quite sure. Further into the trees, where the woods were already darkening toward night, she saw an alder tree with more of those deep claw marks slashed into it. They were high up, where only a very tall man could have reached. Not that Trisha believed a man had made the marks.
"It's been watching you."
Yes, and was watching again right now. She could feel eyes crawling on her skin the way the little bugs, the minges and no-see-ums, crawled there. She might have dreamed the three priests, or hallucinated them, but she wasn't hallucinating the deer guts or the claw marks on the alder. She wasn't hallucinating the feel of those eyes, either. Breathing hard, her own eyes jerking from side to side in their sockets, Trisha backed toward the sound of the stream, expecting to see it in the woods, the god of the lost. She broke free of the underbrush and, clutching small branches, backed all the way to the stream. When she was there, she whirled and leaped across it on the rocks, partly convinced that even now it was bursting out of the woods behind her, all fangs, claws, and stingers. She slipped on the second rock, almost fell into the water, managed to keep her balance, and staggered up on the far bank. She turned and looked back. Nothing over there. Even most of the butterflies were gone now, although one or two still danced, reluctant to give up the day. This would probably be a good place to spend the night, close to the checkerberry bushes and the beechnut clearing, but she couldn't stay where she had seen the priests. They were probably just figures in a dream. But the one in the black robe had been horrible. Also, there was the fawn. Once the flies did arrive in force, she would hear them buzzing. Trisha opened her pack, got a handful of berries, then paused.
"Thank you," she told them. "You're the best food I ever ate, you know."
She set off downstream again, hulling and munching a few beechnuts as she went. After a little bit, she began to sing, at first tentatively, and then with surprising enthusiasm as the day waned.
"Put your arms around me, 'cause I gotta get next to you. All your love forever. Oh, you make me feel brand new. Yeah, baby."